Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Physicians in obstetrics and gynecology provide care to patients from puberty through menopause and beyond. Women's healthcare faces mounting challenges, funding cuts, staffing shortages, and fewer places to access care. Hanging in the balance, the health of pubescent girls, expectant moms and their babies, and menopausal women. And widening already existing wealth and racial gaps. Joining us this hour is Dr. Tani Malhotra, a maternal fetal medicine OBGYN in Cleveland. She's also an associate professor of reproductive biology at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. Malhotra.
Thank you so much for having me.
So one of the things that sparked our interest in this topic was a recent report that detailed the national shortage of OBGYNs. And that seemed to be the case in Ohio, too. There was a KFF report in 2021 that found that more than 20 counties in the state do not have an OBGYN. So that was a few years ago. What's the latest? Is that still true, or is it better? Is it worse?
I'd say it's worse. So the data for Ohio is that 13 to 24 counties have either no OBGYN or are considered a maternity care desert, which means no OBGYN, no one to provide maternal care, obstetric care, or facility to deliver in. That's 13 counties, and then 24 counties have no OBGYNs in them. So yes, I think the problem continues to get worse.
Are there enough doctors in the state dedicated to women's health care, specifically reproductive health? They're just not in these counties, or is there a doctor shortage overall, too?
So that's a great question. There was a recent study that just published this month that used HRSA data to look at what the adequacy of OBGYNs is across the country. And so nationally, if 100% is where we need to be, nationally mm-hmm. we're at about 88% currently of mm-hmm. where we should be. And in Ohio, we're at about 90%. But the study looked at projections of what we expect to be at in 2035, and pretty consistently across the United States, and Ohio was no exception, we are expecting to see a reduction in that adequacy. So we're expecting to see even fewer OBGYNs than we need to be able to care for all of our Ohioans.
Why are you anticipating fewer OBGYNs? Are there less people going into the specialty?
So great question. And I will just say, I'd be remiss not to say that it's not just OBGYNs. Mm-hmm. We expect a shortage for all physicians. Mm-hmm. So the estimated shortage by 2035 is 140,000 physicians across all specialties. OBGYN is a little bit unique in that the issues are both related to early retirement, but also pipeline issues. And so when we think about early retirement, we're seeing more people leave the specialty earlier. And this can be for a variety of reasons. We're looking at burnout and moral injury being a large part of them. Burnout is resulting from, more administrative burdens for physicians, more mm-hmm. government interference in practice, or requiring prior authorizations, insurance interference in care that we are trained to provide that is then being obstructed because of administrative reasons and requiring additional paperwork, additional time to be able to provide the care. So moving away from clinical care and into more administrative work. Mm. Abortion restrictions, and that's more nationally we're seeing this, where people are leaving earlier or leaving states where there are more abortion restrictions. And then, of course, medical, legal, and litigation concerns, which OBGYN continues to be to bear the brunt of that, specifically obstetrics, where lawsuits are just more common. And so we even see more people just dropping the obstetrics portion of their care, of their practice, and transitioning to GYN only. from a pipeline issue, since the 1990s, there has been a congressional cap on the number of Medicare-funded residency positions. And that continues to be the case. There was a bill that was introduced this session, which does allow for an increase of, I believe it's 14,000 residents, Medicare-funded residency spots over the next 7 years if approved. But it's not yet had a hearing. Other pipeline issues. And so, even from that, like people continue to be interested in OBGYN. We have seen a consistent increase in the number of positions, even if they're not funded through Medicare. Hospitals are investing in it. And the number, so for OBGYN and for all residencies, people go through a match process. So you go in, you apply for a program, you interview at all the programs, and then it goes into a match and you're assigned your location. OBGYN matches at 99%, and it has over the last several years. And several people who are interested in the specialty end up not matching into a position. And so we're seeing sort of a shortage on both ends where people are not being able to come in as fast as people are leaving.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess being a doctor is hard and it's expensive. You have to go to a lot of schooling and it's not an easy job and you work, long hours. But and being an OB, you work all the hours because babies are not born between 9 and 5. And then you have to worry about being sued if a miscarriage is deemed an abortion or something like that. So I can see why it would be hard to convince people to go into the specialty. I mean, you're an ex officio member of the Education Committee for the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. So how is a national organization like that working to promote the specialty?
Yeah, as I said, the interest in the specialty continues. And in fact, the interest in the specialty exceeds the number of training positions available for the specialty. And so how ACOG has been working, which is the American College of OBGYNs, is continuing to advocate for Medicare funding for GME positions, continuing to advocate for rural programs, the Rural Planning and Development Act, to be able to sponsor and provide grants for rural programs for residencies. Continuing to fight for better reimbursement for physicians who are in practice, because with Medicare's funding, we've seen over the last 10 years a 33% reduction in physician reimbursement. So physicians who want to work, who want to continue to provide the care, are having to shutter their offices. And in fact, there was a recent, not recent now, several months ago, a physician in Dayton, Ohio, an OBGYN, who closed her practice because she just couldn't keep the lights on after having years of worked in losses and just sort of like sponsored things out of her own pocket. And so ACOG is working to be able to advocate for all of those issues that are both working on getting more people in, as well as preventing some of those reasons that people are leaving early.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about women's health care with Dr. Tani Malhotra, an OBGYN physician specializing in maternal fetal medicine in Cleveland. Let's dig in a little bit into that, the lack of OBGYNs in rural areas, these maternity care deserts. Because you said, Ohio has upwards of almost 90% of the positions are filled, so there's doctors out there, but how do we get them to work in the rural areas, or is there just nowhere for them to work because the hospital closed? Is it both?
Yeah, it is definitely both. I think so. If we start at the sort of the front end of the lifespan of an OBGYN or any trainee, what we know is that people tend to practice in areas that they have trained. And having rural residency positions, so rural sites where people can train, increases the likelihood that they will stay in those areas and train. Ohio, so there is something. So HRSA has this grant, which is the Rural Residency Planning and Development Act, or a program, which they provide grants. Ohio last received that grant in 2020. And so when we invest in having programs that are in the rural areas that residents can train at, they're more likely to stay on and continue to work in that area. From the other end of that spectrum, I would it, since 2020, 9 labor and deliveries have closed in Ohio. 21% of those were in rural parts of the state. So when we close down maternity units, labor and delivery units, we then disincentivize people working in that area, or not just disincentivize, but there's nowhere for them to work. In rural Ohio, only 41 rural hospitals in Ohio have no labor and delivery. And on average, the median time that an Ohio resident will drive to get to a labor and delivery is 30 minutes. And that's the median time. I will tell you, I see patients who drive an hour and a half to come see me. And so I think that the problem lies on both sides, and solutions lie on both sides, with hospitals being willing to invest in maternity care units, which, like you said at the start, they're 24-hour, we run 24/7. And even when there's nobody coming in for care at the time, you still have to staff the unit with nurses and physicians who, in a system where physician reimbursement is fee for service, when there's no service being provided, keeping that unit open actually results in some losses, and hospitals have to be willing to make an investment into those.
That was my next question. Is labor and delivery doesn't make any money? Is that the
I am not an expert on how money is made at hospitals, so I cannot comment exactly to that. But it's not so labor and delivery has a lot of different fixed costs, right? You have to keep the lights on, you have to have anesthesia available, nursing staff, physician staff, both anesthesia as well as obstetrics. And that those costs exist regardless of how many patients you end up delivering. And so and in addition to that, you have to have pediatric staff and pediatric nursing, because when those patients come in and deliver, you have to have somebody to take care of those babies as well. And so those are there are just there's a lot more costs that exist that people don't always think about when we say, oh, we have to keep this labor and delivery open. It's not just about are OBGYNs willing to go and practice in those locations. It's are we willing to invest in those?
And you mentioned just a moment ago that you have patients that drive an hour and a half to come see you. So are you in the city of Cleveland, and these are patients who are in more rural counties surrounding Cleveland, and they don't have anywhere to go?
That's correct. I take care of patients that are that have high risk concerns in their pregnancies, and so yeah, I have patients that drive in from like Ashtabula, Ashland, Painesville, sometimes all the way right up at the border of Pennsylvania, that drive all the way in to Cleveland to come and see us.
And it might be that they are somewhere where there are other OBs, but maybe not someone with a specialty in high risk like you are. Is that true too?
Yes, correct.
So the Affordable Care Act subsidies expired on the first of the year after Congress failed to reach an agreement, a lapse that impacts 20 million Americans, over half a million Ohioans. How does lack of insurance or just having to pay more, like higher healthcare premiums, how do you think that impacts women's healthcare?
Where do I start? So thankfully, in 2022 in Ohio, we did approve coverage of mater of Medicaid coverage for 12 months postpartum. The even with the HR1, with the changes, pregnancy continues to be a covered event for patients to receive Medicaid. I think, of course, with any time you see an increase in insurance costs or administrative burdens to be able to receive the insurance, we're going to just see patients not receive care when they should have. And I think this has many downstream effects in that patients may not receive timely prenatal care. Patients may not feel like they have another one of the other changes is that the time that people have to get their care retroactively covered has been reduced as well from 3 months to 1 month. So they may not be willing to come in to get their care because they don't know if they're going to get reimbursed for that initial care if it takes longer than a month for them to be able to get enrolled in Medicaid. All of those delays essentially result, and we know this from years of data, is that adequacy of prenatal care, so timely entry into prenatal care and receiving an adequate amount of prenatal care, improves prenatal outcomes. And any barriers to that, whether those are administrative barriers, whether those are insurance barriers, will ultimately influence our perinatal outcomes.
Is there also a correlation between postpartum insurance coverage and improved outcomes following the birth? Because I mean, you said that did you say it was covering, 12 months after they give birth? But does everyone have access to that kind of care?
Yes. So in 2022 is when it was approved. It's for all pregnant patients have Medicaid coverage for the 12 months postpartum, and that's good at least till 2027. What happens after 2027 remains yet to be seen. And so the reasons that we fought so hard, and the Ohio ACOG is credited with a lot of that advocacy, is that we know that a majority of pregnancy-related deaths occur after pregnancy, occur in that postpartum period, with more than half of them occurring after those first 6 weeks that we used to have coverage for all pregnant patients. Additionally, patients will, again, speaking from a perspective of someone who takes care of high-risk patients, patients that came into pregnancy, say with diabetes or high blood pressures, that didn't have health insurance, came into pregnancy in poor health without their diabetes or hypertension in good control. We then worked really hard to get them under control during their pregnancy, control being directly correlated with outcomes, preterm birth and infant mortality as well. And then they would deliver and lose their insurance. And then we would start that cycle again with their next pregnancy. And so at least allowing us to have the 12 months postpartum of coverage allows us to continue to care to make sure those patients remain engaged with care and have access to care to manage their medical comorbidities.
Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Malhotra, and we're going to bring on one of Ohio State Wexner Medical Center's nurse midwives to get that perspective. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Physicians in obstetrics and gynecology, along with nurse midwives, provide care to patients from puberty through menopause. A recent survey by the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center found that nearly all Americans did not realize that midwives do more than deliver babies. They provide a continuum of care from puberty through menopause, and that care may be more important to know about as women's health care faces mounting challenges, funding cuts, staffing shortages, and fewer places to access care. Still with us is Dr. Tani Malhotra, an OBGYN physician specializing in maternal fetal medicine in Cleveland. Thanks again for being with us this morning, Dr. Malhotra.
Thank you again for having me.
And joining us now is Helen Dale, a nurse midwife at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, where she is one of 17 midwives in the midwifery program. Welcome to All Sides, Helen. Are you
there? Thank you for having me.
Yeah, there we go. Hi, Helen. Okay, so first off, address that survey that I just mentioned. Why do you think there's a lack of awareness at what a midwife provides? I guess tell us what a midwife provides besides delivering a baby.
I think just historically, we understand midwives as like, you know, birthing babies, you know, and helping women have children. But there's like that unknown history that midwives used to be the like the healthcare providers for communities when no other physicians or, you know, medical care was an option, essentially. And I feel like, you know, we've been, it's very easy to say, you know, midwives take care of pregnant women. And it's just that sometimes women don't know that you don't have to be pregnant for us to help take care of you.
So what else does a midwife do besides, you know, helping birth a baby?
We do, I mean, obviously normal GYN annual visit care. We can do problem visits if you think you have an infection of some kind. We can, you know, if you've got concerns about your period bleeding, things of that nature, concerns about, you know, frequently, obviously we see women with, you know, mastitis or breast infections after delivery, or if they have a concern about a possible breast lump, we would help refer them and get them to the right people, essentially.
And Helen, the level of risk tends to differentiate when, what a midwife handles versus when an OBGYN handles it. So can you give us an example of when it, you have to hand it over to an OBGYN instead of a midwife?
Obviously, if a patient is, you know, looking at surgical care or, you know, surgical options, that is no longer within my realm as a nurse midwife. That's something that I would refer to one of my backup physicians for. And then if I, you know, if it's something that I am not comfortable with or don't feel that I have enough expertise in, I would typically consult and then refer to one of my backup physicians if I felt that was the next best step.
Dr. Malhotra, you are a high-risk maternal-fetal medicine physician in the Cleveland area. Are you seeing patients who fall into this category where they've seen a midwife and then they need to come to you or they're referred to you? How would you characterize, you know, the midwife relationship to what you do?
Oh, very collegial. And, you know, they are partners in our provision of prenatal care for patients. Additionally, as Helen said, you know, and Ohio Medicaid has a comprehensive maternal care program, which is a value-based care program for the state. One of the things that they ask is that we make sure patients are seen within the within 12 weeks of their delivery by a primary care provider. And we use our midwives as that primary care provider for our patients to be seen in that postpartum, like after they've delivered, after they've completed their prenatal care. I think there are a lot of patient preferences too, who say, I would prefer to be seen by a midwife, in which case we physicians, either high-risk OBs or general OBGYNs, serve as consultants and collaborators with our midwives so that they may continue to provide the obstetrical care and we provide the consultation on their medical comorbidities.
And Helen, I called you a nurse midwife. So is there a difference between a midwife and having the word nurse midwife in front of it?
So a nurse midwife is a RN who has gone on to receive a master's degree or higher. There are other midwives, certified midwives, certified professional midwives. They have different paths to practice, so to speak. Currently in the state of Ohio, I believe that nurse midwives are the only officially recognized, like legal certified licensed bodies in the state of Ohio.
Okay. Dr. Malhotra, you're nodding. Is that so? A nurse midwife, if it's just a midwife without the word nurse before it, are they kind of practicing in a different way?
I'm nodding because I had a meeting yesterday because there are two bills that are being introduced to license CNM, so it's certified nurse midwives. The ones that we work with primarily are our CNMs, which is the certified nurse midwives.
Okay. So Helen, what kind of schooling did you have to go through? Did you become a nurse first and add the midwife part on, or like which way
yes.
did it go? Yeah.
So I received my bachelor's here at Ohio State first, and then I went on to get my master's degree at Vanderbilt. And then I came back to Ohio State to get a PhD. But there are programs where people who have bachelor's degrees can go directly into midwifery school. They do kind of an accelerated RN, and then they go on to do the midwifery education and training and are able to sit for the midwifery certification exam.
And then, Helen, I mean, anecdotally, I feel like people pick to see a midwife or they see a midwife because the midwives tend to have more time to spend with them than maybe a busy OBGYN. Is that true, or are there other reasons that I'm not thinking of?
We try to spend as much time with our patients. I mean, we are still in the constraints, unfortunately, of the U.S. healthcare system and numbers and patients scheduled every so often. I feel like we also take the time to listen and actively, let the patients participate in their care. We're not. I'm never going to tell my patient that they have to do something. I will provide them with options. But I feel like that's probably the most common reason that people feel like we're kind of more personalized.
And Dr. Malhotra, we were talking earlier about, the rural areas that lack OBGYNs or the maternity care deserts. Do you know if midwives can fill some of that gap?
I would say, I think as long as it is with collaboration and what we call physician-led care. So where we're working with physicians and we make sure that our CNMs or our midwives know when to identify that this is no longer a low-risk situation and this is the time that we must hand off care or to be able to consult a physician at the right time.
And Helen, what would you say to that about, because I know you work at at OSU's Wexner Medical Center, obviously right in the heart of the city, but there is a lack of maternity care in rural areas. I mean, when you talk with other midwives, is this something that midwives talk about to try to help pregnant women in rural areas?
I do think like it is a an area that we can help. I felt cut, help with the shortage. But I agree that, I tell people my job is not to replace the physician. I work in conjunction with my physician colleagues. They are my backup. They are my consultants. But can we help? Absolutely. Or can we do it alone? Not necessarily.
Okay. So can you tell me the difference too between a midwife and a doula, Helen?
So a midwife is a licensed, personnel. My job is to provide you with actual health care. A doula is their job is to provide you with education and labor support, typically. And a lot of them offer, birth photography or lactation services after the baby is born. I, as a health care provider, provide you with direct care and I can provide you with education, but perhaps, if you have more in-depth questions, perhaps your doula can help you answer that, or your doula can help you figure out what questions you need to ask at your next appointment so that you can get the answers that you're looking for.
Okay. And in your role, Helen, do you see patients throughout their whole pregnancy, or are you there just mainly for the birthing process?
I see patients throughout their whole pregnancy. That's probably one of my favorite parts of being a nurse midwife is building that relationship with my patients and getting to see them and know them well over visits and then, over multiple children. I feel like that's kind of one of the best parts of my job.
And do midwives, do they do home births, or I'm not sure. I don't really know much about home births.
So there are midwives that do home births. We, as the OSU midwives, do not do home births. We do all of our births at the OSU Wexner Medical Center. Again, I feel like a majority of the midwives that are doing home births are currently midwives that are not licensed by the state of Ohio. But those are midwives that usually have another path through becoming midwives, essentially.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about women's health care with Dr. Tani Malhotra, an OBGYN physician specializing in maternal fetal medicine in Cleveland. And also with us is Helen Dale, a nurse midwife at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, where she is one of 17 midwives. Dr. Malhotra, how do OBGYNs and midwives work together when it's a labor and delivery setting?
Different labor and deliveries probably have different setups. I will say ours, you know, like Helen said, our midwives have their own patients that they care for. So they've taken care of their patients for, they've taken care of their prenatal care. And then when they come into labor and delivery, they manage their labor and their delivery unless there is a need for a physician to step in. Like I said at the beginning, you know, we work in a very collaborative and collegial manner. So sometimes if it's a busy floor and it's a physician patient and, you know, they're having an otherwise uncomplicated labor, our midwives will step in and help us out with managing their labors or even stepping into their deliveries. Vice versa, if the midwives have a really busy labor and delivery, they have a bunch of patients on the board, then we as the physicians will step in and help them as we need.
Do either of you know, do all hospitals have midwives, or is this unique to OSU?
In the Central Ohio area, I know that there is, I know of one other practice that has midwives, but I do believe that a lot of the other hospitals employ midwives. I don't know if they work in the full scope as seeing patients outpatient like we do here at Ohio State.
Dr. Malhotra, what do you know?
I think more hospitals are starting to invest into having midwives, but that was not always the case. Not all labor and deliveries had midwives on them, but I think more hospitals are starting to invest in that.
So what we talked about earlier, Dr. Malhotra, with these labor and delivery units having to close because they have to be staffed 24/7, whether a baby's born or not. I mean, could hiring a midwife, multiple midwives, help out with that? You could have like one doctor on staff and then midwives on call or something. Like, could that help in these rural areas if hospitals were willing to look into it?
Certainly, I think that is one way, one of the solutions where that can be pursued, where people have multiple midwives that are managing care. But unfortunately, as the nature of pregnancy care, labor and delivery goes, that's something that's totally low risk can turn into high risk in the blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. And so making sure that those labor and delivery units are adequately staffed, both with obstetric physicians, anesthesia physicians and nursing staff, continue to be issues that need to be addressed, even though, you know, you may just have a board full of low risk patients, but that can change in the moment.
And Helen, walk us through a little bit more about what a midwife does for gynecological care. So if someone's not pregnant, you mentioned you enjoy that your favorite part of the job is seeing a patient throughout their entire pregnancy, you know, getting to know them and seeing them through the whole pregnancy. But do you also see women who are not pregnant at all and just come to you for maybe a pap smear?
No, absolutely. I tell, I frequently have patients who, once they've delivered and have their postpartum visit, they're like, so do I come back here? I'm like, yeah, I'll see you in a year for your annual exam. Come on back.
Okay. So, I mean, so you can function just like an OBGYN's office and do all those services, except for you don't have the doctor part in front of your name. Is that how it works?
I mean, yes. I mean, obviously, like I said, complicated things, people who end up needing surgery for something. I would refer to one of my physicians, my colleagues, you know, in office or at one of the other OSU offices if need be. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I can I do a lot of the basic care things? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But, you know, once you know, if your pap smear is abnormal and you need further testing, then I'm going to refer you to one of my backup physicians. Mm.
We talked a lot about money earlier in the show because everything costs money. So, Helen, do insurance companies cover the cost of midwifery?
My understanding is that they cover the cost of nurse midwifery. You know, if you have the appropriate billing sources and, you know, the appropriate people to do the billing. But I don't know if they cover the cost of non-midwife services. Non-nurse midwife services.
right. Dr. Malhotra, do you know if you want to hire a midwife who's not a nurse midwife, do you pay them?
You pay them out of pocket.
Okay.
Usually, yeah. Like the home births and stuff, I usually paid out of pocket.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. So, Helen, what are the demographics, or do you know, like, who decides to become a midwife? Do you know, where this idea comes from whenever someone decides they want to be a midwife?
I feel like it's different for everyone. Some women have children and they decide that, they want to provide women with the same support that they had. Lots of nurses that we work with in labor and delivery, love what they do and they recognize they can provide a higher level of care to women, and so they go back to school to do so. I don't have, like, every midwife I know has a different story on how they ended up, they decided midwifery was for them. Mine was, I was in nursing school and I watched my first vaginal delivery and I thought, this is great. Everybody should do this. And everyone does not feel that way.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for coming on and telling us about what it means to be a nurse midwife. We've been talking with Helen Dale, a certified nurse midwife at Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. Thank you for your time, Helen.
Thank you for having me.
And staying with us is Dr. Malhotra, an OBGYN specializing in maternal fetal medicine in Cleveland. We are going to be coming up. We're going to be talking with the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio. That is When All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Women's healthcare faces mounting challenges, from funding cuts to staffing shortages to fewer places to access care. In Ohio and across the U.S., there's a shortage of OBGYNs, and there are maternity care deserts, longer drives to access care. In addition, Planned Parenthood, which provides a range of health services in addition to abortion, is among the organizations experiencing seismic changes. Clinics are shutting down or laying off staff here and elsewhere. And hanging in the balance is the health of pubescent girls, expectant moms and their babies, and menopausal women, and the widening of the already existing wealth and racial gaps. Still with us is Dr. Tani Malhotra, an OBGYN physician specializing in maternal fetal medicine in Cleveland. Thanks again for being with us today, Dr. Malhotra.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And joining us now is Erica Wilson Domer, President and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio. Welcome to All Sides, Erica.
Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for having me.
Erica, can you give us an update on how Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio has been impacted by the funding losses and recent Medicaid cuts?
Yes, so we have definitely, and more importantly, our patients have been greatly impacted by these recent funding cuts. So we've been experiencing cuts, I would say, pretty steadily, both at the state and federal level since the first Trump administration. But in this last year, we've lost the equivalent to about $10 million in funding between Medicaid being barred from the Medicaid program, participating in the Medicaid program, as well as some shifts in Title X funding, which is meant to support contraceptive services, well visits, and infection checks. And then at the state level, we had been defunded, again, about 6 years previously, I think, is when we lost the final court battle on the state defunding. And so we've been barred essentially from receiving any funds through the Ohio Department of Health for any of the work that we do. That impacted several of our maternal health programs and initiatives. We had a program called Healthy Moms, Healthy Babies in Mahoning and Trumbull County, which is, one of the two of the counties that are most impacted by the horrific maternal and fetal outcomes that we have here in Ohio. And so that we were barred from receiving funds for those type of programs. So that has resulted in us necessarily sort of reducing to our new patient volume as we're no longer able to serve Medicaid patients.
Well, and Erica, you mentioned that, so this past September, Planned Parenthood can no longer accept Medicaid payments following the Trump administration's defunding action. So let's talk a little bit more about that. So you were receiving, you know, to be clear, there was no federal funding being used for abortion care. That's long been prohibited by federal law. But there was Medicaid money being used for other things up until fall. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So the Hyde Amendment prohibits any federal funds from being used for anything related to abortion. And so, you know, particularly at Planned Parenthood, where we are always under a microscope, we are very conscientious, concerned. We keep meticulous records, as we have been in the past, audited by literally every agency that could ever come to audit. We have been audited by. And so no federal funds are ever used for abortion services. Likewise, on the state level with Medicaid, the state of Ohio does not cover any abortion services. And although they will tell you that they cover four cases of rape and incest, in our experience, they rarely pay those claims either. So state funds are also not used, right, in the provision of abortion. It is, in Ohio, 100% for the most part, self-pay. There are some commercial plans who will cover abortion services for patients. But unless there are pretty extenuating circumstances, it's pretty much self-pay. So those funds have been very separate. So this Medicaid defund and the state defunding that has happened has really been, the funds that have been impacted are the funds that go to serve women's health in terms of wellness, contraception, preserving fertility, family planning. Those are the programs that have been really impacted, not so much abortion. And so it's really sort of counterintuitive, this idea of defunding Planned Parenthood because of abortion, because in fact, the opposite effect happens, right? So our goal is to educate people on their reproductive health. Our goal is to educate them about how to make the best choices they can make for themselves regarding their health, regarding family planning, and for their future. And so by reducing this funding and taking away these funds, they have in effect created a situation that has the opposite of what the stated policy is meant to be, right?
Earlier this year, two clinics in Planned Parenthood's Southwest Ohio region were closed due to cuts. And then the Franklinton Clinic here in Columbus closed in late November. There were some issues to be worked out with the union, but do you know how many layoffs we're talking about here?
Over the course of the last year, year and a half, I would say we have reduced our overall workforce by almost 33%, about 30 to 33%. So we have reduced both administratively and we have reduced on the front line, and which is just heartbreaking, especially because, you know, our staff are here because they really believe in this mission. They believe in helping people. They believe in ensuring that our patients get good quality care. And so we have had to, unfortunately, part ways with some just really dedicated staff who are here for patients every day, and it's heartbreaking.
Dr. Tani Malhotra, an OBGYN in Cleveland, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation here. What are your thoughts on these federal funding cuts to women's health care as it relates to Planned Parenthood? You know, we talked earlier about cuts causing shortages and access to care, but what does losing clinics like Planned Parenthood, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, thank you. As Erica said, it really does result in the opposite effect, right? Our colleagues at Planned Parenthood were providing some of the same services that we would provide with a physician shortage that already exists, that is only anticipated to worsen. We are reducing access by taking away a key component of key way in which patients were receiving care. So oftentimes patients were going to Planned Parenthood to get their pap smear because it was easier for them to just walk into a Planned Parenthood than to navigate the healthcare system that is America, right? Mm-hmm. They were perhaps going to Planned Parenthood to consider or discuss abortion, finding out they had a miscarriage, and now Planned Parenthood was managing their miscarriage. Guess what's going to happen? Now, all of these people are going to need to come into the traditional or the hospital-based healthcare system, which is already thin and access is already a problem, and now they're just going to wait longer or not get seen at all, which means more unintended and undesired pregnancies, more patients that are not getting the screenings that they require, more patients that do not have access to contraception. So really, it worsens our conditions of access and our workforce shortage.
We're talking about the impacts of federal funding cuts on women's health care with Erica Wilson-Domer, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio, and with Dr. Tawny Malhotra, an OBGYN physician specializing in maternal fetal medicine in Cleveland. Erica, back to you. What percentage of your patients in Ohio are seeking non-abortion services? Because I feel like so much of the conversation around Planned Parenthood always seems to end up at abortion.
I would say fully 90% or more of our patients are seeking care that is not abortion related in any way, shape, or form.
So 90%? 90?
Yes. Okay. That would include well visits, STI or infection checks, contraceptive counseling, general education, sometimes just general health concerns. So I wanted to sort of add on to something Dr. Malhotra had said earlier, which is, you know, at Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio, we also provide primary care services, and we do in all of our centers a limited scope of primary care, such as diabetes, testing for diabetes, and non-insulin dependent diabetes management, hypertension testing and management. And so in talking about this maternal fetal crisis that we have here in Ohio, Planned Parenthood is a key player in managing that crisis and can be good partners in helping to ensure that the health and welfare of Ohioans, our communities, are generally healthier, because often women will come to us for their pregnancy test or for that first reported pregnancy. And our clinicians are able to assess them in that moment and say, okay, let's do a workup. Let's look at your blood pressures. Let's look at your sugar. Let's look at some of these other issues. And let's get those addressed while we refer you to your delivering provider. Because often, because there's a shortage, it takes months to get into a delivering provider if you don't have that relationship established. And that's if you can find a provider that will accept Medicaid. 50% of births in Ohio are paid for by Medicaid, and many OBGYNs will not accept Medicaid because the reimbursement is terrible. So again, this is a policy decision. I know Dr. Malhotra had mentioned that she's not a hospital finance expert, but I worked in hospital finance for many years before I came to Planned Parenthood. And I can tell you that 50% of births being paid for by Medicaid. Medicaid reimbursement is terrible, and we do not reimburse for healthy births. We do not value and prioritize healthy birth outcomes in our reimbursement system. What gets reimbursed is sick babies in the NICU. That's how a hospital can make money. So hospitals having maternity wards is very much a community service, because they lose money on maternity wards generally, particularly if they have very healthy births. The way to flip that is policy. If you change the way you reimburse the system, if you change the policy and you reimburse for healthy outcomes and you reward for healthy outcomes, guess what? You get healthier outcomes, right? Because that's how people can survive and sustain and make money. So this is very much a policy-driven outcome that our legislature has chosen to prioritize ideology instead of real data and outcomes, which tell us that if you reimburse and you prioritize healthy births and healthy outcomes, and you subsidize that, and not just subsidize, but reimburse for the work people are doing appropriately, that will increase, right, our healthy outcomes and our community health overall. So I think there are real answers and achievable answers to these crises. It's the will to change how we engage in the system and how we as a people, as a state, reward and reimburse for good outcomes.
And just before we run out of time, Erica, with this change with the Medicaid funding, patients who went to Planned Parenthood, especially lower income women, if they're not able to afford basic gynecological care, where are you advising them to go if Planned Parenthood can't accept Medicaid payments?
So we have a variety of partners, community partners. We also keep a really robust referral list, and we work in partnership with a lot of various community partners, understanding that there is no shortage of patients. Mm-hmm. We are not in competition. We are here to make sure everybody gets exactly what they need. And so that's been, I think, one of the really silver lining, good outcomes of sort of where we are in this world, is that we are able to work more closely with a lot of our partners to say, you know, this is a patient that I maybe can't serve best, but I'm going to direct them towards you. And they have patients that they can direct toward us. Because again, the system is overloaded and it's so challenging to get in, to get an appointment. And so one of the benefits to Planned Parenthood has always been that we often have same day, next day availability, that people are able to see us when they can. We have a very robust telehealth program as well. And so we do see a lot of people on telehealth. We offer that 7 days a week. And so and I think another really critical piece of Planned Parenthood being a part of the safety net is that it is a really trusted brand, and it's a trusted brand for a reason, because our sort of motto is care no matter what, right? We are here not to judge you. We are here not to judge your choices. We're here to provide education and provide good healthcare so that you can make the best choices for yourself. And people feel that they can come and be heard, which is so important.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we've been talking about the impacts of federal funding cuts to Planned Parenthood with Erica Wilson-Domer, President and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio. Thank you for your time today, Erica.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also thank you to Dr. Tani Malhotra, an OBGYN physician specializing in maternal fetal medicine in Cleveland. Thank you for joining us for the hour today.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.